Everybody in the audience, when it comes your turn to come to the mic, you're welcome to raise your hands. And anybody from the public that's on the webinar, if you could raise your hand, I'll do my best to recognize you. So with that, we're going to start off this morning with our usual reports. And I'm going to start off with the executive committee report. Most of what we talked about in the executive committee will be covered in our various presentations. So that's pretty much my report. Mr. Neese has a few topics that he's going to run through that weren't covered extensively in our discussion, but basically everything that I would say is going to be repeated, so I'm not going to do it. So with that, first report, Mr. Neese. Actually, I probably should start out with saying, if you haven't heard by now, Mr. Neese has decided to move on to the next section of his life sometime in, hopefully by August 1st. And there will be a press release on that today. And as soon as possible, we will solicit for a new executive director. And the council has a way forward on how we're going to handle selecting the new executive director when the time comes. So with that, Mr. Neese.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is going to be the typical executive director report. All the documents are under tab one in your binder under the ED report. There are three documents in there. Number 1A is on the budget, 1B is on the program review. Joan distributed a third document in email this morning, document 1C, which is a memo. You might want to dig that one out at least, because we will talk about that, and there may be a motion on that particular memo during when I complete my report. So I'll start out as usual with a budget report. I'm not going to actually go through it in too much detail. There has not been a lot of change since December. The one thing I will point out is that once all our bills are in and paid, we do expect to have expended our entire award for 2022 in 2022 and slightly more. That's somewhat notable because I think most of you know that 2020 and 2021, we didn't spend a lot of money on travel, and so we have a kind of a cushion. But you can see that our expenses are now coming up to our award. We still have a pretty decent surplus from not having any travel for those 2 years. We have about 2 years left on our grant cycle in which we have to spend that surplus, so we will be spending it, bluntly. I will talk a little bit about the 2023 appropriations bill. These are my takes. These are not coming from anybody else. I'm saying that so Mike Pentney and Dr. Hare don't have to disavow what I'm saying. But anyway, with respect to the appropriations bill, the council commission line item looks to have about a 3% budget increase. We will not know until May whether we actually get that 3%. Typically, we get a little less than what's in the council commission line direction from Congress. But that's, you know, not bad for us. That's roughly what we've been getting every year for the last couple of years. So I'm not anticipating any problems with our budget this year, particularly in light of the fact that we still have that surplus left over from the travel. However, I personally do have a few concerns about the agency's budget. The agency's increase from 1 year to the next is, I want to say, somewhere just south of 2%, which is not a very big increase given inflation. And given some of the shortfalls we've seen in, for example, biological sampling and some of the other things. In addition, there is a lot of congressional direction in the agency's budget on how they're supposed to spend their money. I'm sure you've all seen the news articles about some of the money that's been awarded to deal with the right whale and lobster issues and that type of thing. So it's unclear, you know, what the impacts of the federal budget will be on the agency and what the agency can provide for support to the councils. I'm not quite sure how long it takes the agency to get their spend plan together. We usually don't find out our part of the spend plan until the May CCC meeting. But I just want to highlight that there may be some concerns with the agency side of the federal budget, even though there are not any concerns at present on my side with the council budget going forward. So stay tuned. That's what that boils down to. I usually go over the program review. There has only been a couple things done on the program review, one of which will take place, I think, tomorrow morning. So there's not a lot of change to the program review report. Tomorrow morning, you all have a presentation. It's primarily going to be by Dr. Steve Cadron, who I think many of you know. The report was prepared in consultation with our SSC chair and vice chair on addressing uncertainty in the management process. This is one of the items that the program review suggested the council talk about a little bit. I think one of the things that would be helpful going forward is, as you listen to that presentation tomorrow morning, try and think if there are specific questions you have about uncertainty that you would like to have addressed through future presentations. Because, you know, we're shooting in the dark a little bit on exactly what it is, what information you may want to know or learn about how to deal with uncertainty in the scientific and management processes. I'm going to shift gears now. Give me a minute to shift documents. I'm going to give a little update on, assuming I don't shut the file, give you a little update on staff changes. I'll start with the big one right up front. We have two new hires. I'm going to ask them to stand up when I introduce them so you know who they are. I'm going to start with the one who has got here, I guess, about a week before the other one. Connor Buckley. Connor has a Master's of Science in Fisheries and Wildlife from Michigan State University. Most recently, he's been working on the industry-funded scallop program. He will be working with Dr. Feeney on skates. He's also, once it gets rolling, going to be on the SBRM FMAT. He's also going to assist on a couple other things and probably with helping us provide remote access for EBFM meetings when we get up to speed. He started with us on January 3rd. Our second new hire is just to the right of him, Emily Bedell. She has a Master's of Environmental Management from Duke University's Nicholas School of the Environment. Most recently, she's been a naturalist with the Watch Hill Conservancy. She's also worked with the Rhode Island Coastal Resources Management Authority. We expect Emily to be working on herring and whiting, and she will also very possibly, once we nail down our approach to gillnet measures on sturgeon and right whales, be assisting with that effort. You'll probably hear more of that later. There are some other staff changes to be aware of. We've noted all of these on our webpage, so you don't have to write them down now. You can look on our webpage and tell what they are. I'm going to run through the major changes very quickly, just so you're aware. The priorities list that the council approved is pretty extensive, and we still perhaps have a shortfall in staff resources to accomplish it. But because of some of the things that we've decided to do this year, there's going to be some changes in some of the staff and in how they're approaching their job. The first is Dr. Jamie Kernan will support both the herring FMP and the groundfish FMP. She'll be serving as PDT chair for both of those. In order to facilitate that, we're expecting Robin to take on more of the responsibility of the groundfish workload. And Angela, who has been splitting her time between two FMPs, is going to focus pretty much on groundfish full-time with a couple other side things. Once the monkfish framework is submitted, our intention is that Jenny Couture will shepherd any RSA changes that we make in the monkfish plan. Dr. Feeney will assume, and in reality has already assumed, support to the SSC. Jonathan Piros, who's going to remain chair of the Scala PDT, will be the primary staff lead for the risk policy work group once that gets going. This, of course, means that Sam will take on a larger job and a larger role than he already has with the Scala PDT. Dave McCarron, who you all know, it will staff the enforcement committee. He will participate on the Dogfish FMAT. That, I think, is the summary of the major changes that we have going on. There might be some other changes as we figure out the gillnet approach, and I think this morning we might talk about another working group, and we'll have to figure out how we staff that as we go forward. So this is probably the start of what may be a fluid situation here for a little part of the year until we get everything straightened out and where we're going. I'll pause there to see if there's any questions on the stuff I've talked to about so far, and meanwhile you can try and dig out that document 1C, which is the next thing I'm going to talk about. Joan emailed that to you this morning.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Denise. Any questions for Ms. Denise from the council? Anyone from the audience? Anyone online? Mr. Nice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last part of my report is the, you know, a proposal to correct a longstanding discrepancy between our standard operating procedures and our employee handbook. The councils are authorized by the regulations to establish accounts to fund our annual and sick leave. And we can define payout on separation from the council or death as long as we specify it in our SOPPs. Initially, when the councils started having these sick leave accounts, all the councils had exactly the same policy. And basically, I forget the number, but I think it was 100 days of sick leave was all that could be paid out at any time. In early 2013, we had a council staff member who was diagnosed with a terminal illness. In November of 2013, the executive committee authorized a change to the payment of sick leave upon death to allow the payment for all earned sick leave rather than limiting the payment to a certain number of days. We made that change in the employee handbook, but we never made that change in the SOPPs, which is something our auditor points out to us every year. I'll be honest, one of the reasons why we didn't make it into the SOPs, make the change in the SOPs, is because the review process for the SOPs is incredibly convoluted. My predecessor, Paul Howard, started to get the SOPs approved when he took the job in 1997 or 1998, and they weren't actually approved until something like 2016. Okay, so, cleaning up the books, what I suggest is, I found out at an ED meeting that a lot of the councils are changing their SOPs and they're just not submitting them for approval to the agency so that everything matches, but they don't wind up in this four year or longer do loop while the review goes on. So what I'm suggesting is that we update our SOPs to recognize the change that was approved by the executive committee back in 2013. There's suggested language in the memo. It basically says that in the event of terminal illness or death, the full amount of accumulated sick leave will be paid to the employee or designated survivor. To claim sick leave payment at separation due to a terminal illness, the employee must submit a statement by a physician who specializes in a specific illness or condition, confirming that the illness is terminal. This really doesn't have any immediate or impact on the council's budget should this happen, which hopefully it doesn't happen again. The purpose of the sick, we attempt to have 100% of our sick leave liability funded in our sick leave account at all times. We don't. We have somewhere right now, I think around 77 or 80% funded right now. But should this happen, we would fund this payment out of our sick leave account, which is what it's there for, bluntly. But with that, Mr. Chair, I would seek either council consensus or, if necessary, I think the vice chair has a motion to have this approved in the, and inserted into the SOPs.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Nice. Yeah, I'd prefer to do it by a motion. Let's do it right. Let's see if we have any questions at this point. Anybody from the council have a question? Mr. Salerno.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it was just a quick note that I noticed in here that you have a process, and I'm referring to the red lines that you have in here, that in event of a terminal illness or death, the full amount of accumulated sick leave will be paid to the employee. To claim the sick leave, the payment of separation due to terminal illness, the employee must submit a statement by a physician, blah, 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 blah. But there's no mention on how to claim in the event of death. Is that just kind of understood, or do you feel that that may be appropriate just to put a one line in there to clarify that on how to claim in event of death?
Yeah, that's probably not a good idea. I'm sorry, back up. That's probably not a bad idea. That's what I meant to say. To have some kind of line there that specifies who it goes to if there's no, you know, who claims it. So I'll talk to Margaret and we can insert a line in there. I mean, you know, the example is, if someone has a spouse, it's relatively simple. But what if we have a single person who doesn't have a spouse? You know, who claims it on their behalf if they die without a will or something like that? So I'll talk to Margaret and we'll see if we can come up some language to add in there.
Thank you. Yeah, having a beneficiary defined by the recipient would not be a bad idea, because funny things happen. So anybody else? Ms. Braun.
I think this is, I understand this properly, but I just want to make sure. So if someone is diagnosed with a terminal illness, they can get paid out while they're still alive, correct? That's the goal of this?
That's correct.
Okay.
The specific situation we ran into before is the member retired officially from the council before he passed. And normally, without this change, he would have gotten, I think it was 100 days of sick leave, and he'd been employed for a long time. He had a lot more than that. And so when we made this change, as soon as he retired, we paid him his full sick leave that he had accumulated.
Anyone else from the council? Anybody from the audience? Anybody online? Seeing none, I'm going to turn to Mr. Bellavance. We've got a motion ready to go. Go ahead, Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll make a motion to this effect. I move that the council approves the proposed council SOOP change to the payout of sick leave relative to a terminal illness or death.
Okay, it is not a committee motion. It will need a second. Anybody want to second that? Ms. Etri, you seconding that motion?
I will second the motion with the acknowledgement that Tom will work on the updated language specific to a beneficiary in case of death.
I think we're okay with that. Tom, you okay with that? Okay. So we have a second. Is there any discussion on the motion? Anybody in the audience? Anybody online? Back to the council. Is there any opposition to the motion? Any abstentions? Seeing none, motion passes by unanimous consent. Mr. Nice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That ends my report.
Very good. Next up, I have Mr. Regional Administrator Pentney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A few things to go through, and as always, I'll be happy to take questions. On the topic of groundfish, two things to mention. On January 17th, we published the adjustment rule for the fishing year 2022 sector allocations to describe what's carried over from fishing year 2021. So hopefully everybody was expecting that and shouldn't be too controversial. On December 9th, you'll recall, we published the final rule to implement Amendment 23 beginning December 15th. Sector trips fishing exclusively west of 7130 were excluded from the ASM requirement. All other measures that were in Amendment 23 became effective on January 9th. The human ASM coverage target remains at 80% of sector trips through April 30th, and we'll be working over the next month to focus on the ASM coverage target for 2023. Coming up soon. For scallops, on January 13th, we filed a temporary rule closing the closed area 1 scallop access area for the remainder of the 2023 fishing season to LAGC vessels. That was effective January 14th because they had fished all 100% of the 714 LAGC trips that were allocated to the area. And so that rule obviously expires on March 31st when we end the fishing year. On December 10th of last year, we implemented the herring specs for 2023 that were previously approved through Framework 8. And those were, but the council revised the 2023 specs in September. So we're working on the replacement rule that would replace those default 2023 specs. And that's important because on January 10th and January 12th, we implemented the 2,000-pound possession limits for Area 1B and Area 3, which remain in effect through the end of the calendar year until we're able to update the 2023 specs. And once we update the 2023 specs, we have the option to remove the 2,000-pound possession limit. But first, we'll do a little math and make sure that the new sub-ACLs haven't already been exceeded but presuming that they haven't been exceeded, then we'll remove the 2,000-pound possession limits and then continue to track landings against the 98% trigger. For red crab, we published on January 5th, we published the final rule for the 2023 fishing year for red crab. We remain at 2,000 metric tons, as it has been for many, many years. Let's see. On December 30th, we filed the final rule implementing the 2023 summer flounder, scup, and black sea bass specs. Nothing shocking there, except I will mention that those specifications are consistent with the new commercial and recreational allocations that were adopted in the Mid-Atlantic Council's Amendment 22 to the plan. And there was also a slight modification to states that wanted to participate in a Black Sea Bass Wave 1 recreational fishery. So those allocations were effective, obviously, January 1st. And then there was a letter that's in your binder that we sent on January 18th regarding the Monkfish Research Set-Aside Program. As we had initially not intended to solicit 2023 Monkfish RSA proposals, we heard some input and feedback from the industry and researchers that there was definitely interest in that. So we reconsidered, and the letter describes the process that we're going to use. We're going to pursue an abbreviated process for that, but it'll still be somewhat late. And I know we're going to talk about Monkfish RSA priorities under the Monkfish Committee's report later this week. So we'll hold further discussion on that till then. And that's all I have for now, Mr. Chairman, unless there's any questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Pentney. Any questions from the council? Mr. Neese first.
I apologize if I missed this in the report, Mike, but what's the status of the HAPC action? Is that completed?
Checking my cheat sheet, I do not see it. So I think we are still working on that action, and I don't have an update for you. I can try to get one before the Habitat Committee report later today.
Thank you.
Ms. Etri.
Thank you. A quick question as it relates to Amendment 23 and electronic monitoring, and if you don't have the answer, it might just be more appropriate under the Amendment 23 metric discussion underground fish. But I've heard that, and I understand that a few vessels that had participated in the max retention program opted to leave max retention and go for human observers. And I'm just thinking forward into Amendment 23 metrics and evolution of the programs. Are you guys actively seeking feedback from participants when they leave electronic monitoring programs for human to kind of create some historical information for motivations if the council wants to take that into consideration for subsequent management measures later to incentivize folks in EM programs, if that makes sense?
So yeah, thanks. I mean, I can confirm that we definitely ask for feedback when vessels leave the EM program. I can't describe the specifics of how we do that or obviously what types of feedback we're getting, but we definitely are looking for that input.
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks, Mike. I believe you said that your goal was to announce next month the target coverage rates for 2023. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, as part of Amendment 23, we're supposed to announce the target coverage rate in advance of the sector rosters being due. So we need to get that, you know, out in the next month.
And as part of that announcement, will there also be an announcement on the expected review rates for EM trips? I know there's been some questions about whether the review rate will be 50% or 30% for vessels that have been participating. Is that going to be part of that announcement, or will that be a separate one?
I think that will be separate. It'll probably be after we announce the ASM target. But the one thing to keep in mind with the ASM coverage target is, you know, every year we've been very fortunate. We've gotten some supplemental funding in the Appropriations Act. So thank you, Congress, for that. That helps us to provide funding to reimburse industry. But it's always contingent on approval of a spend plan. that has to go through a very convoluted and cumbersome process. And as you recall, some years the spend plan doesn't actually get approved until quite late in the year. And so when, you know, with Amendment 23, we have an obligation to inform the sectors as to what the likely rate's going to be. It's going to be before we have a spend plan approved. So it's always going to be subject to change based on that process. But we're going to try to do the best we can to give, you know, the sectors an idea of what the likely rate is going to be. It'll be an estimate, but it's, you know, the best we can do while we have the spend plan process to go through.
Got it. Appreciate that. And I just encourage the agency to do what they can to. I understand the announcement on the review rates for EM trips will be subsequent to that one, but if you could do it sooner rather than later, I think that'll be helpful for sector members and sector managers to know what that will be. So anything you can do on that would be appreciated. Thanks.
Anyone else from the council have questions for Mr. Pentney? Anybody from the public? Mr. Minkiewicz.
Thank you, Drew Minkiewicz, on behalf of the Red Crab Fishery. It was the last meeting you gave an update that you were changing course on how you're looking at implementing the rules for the National Monument. I was wondering if there's any update on the progress or what's happening there.
Thanks for the question. I had fully intended to have an update to provide the council on that process. Unfortunately, I do not. Still working through some of the legal implications of our options. And don't unfortunately have an answer for you.
Okay, and I appreciate that. But so as of right now, there's no timeline on a proposed rule or anything of that nature?
Nothing official, although the I know that our NOAA leaders expect the rule to be implemented by September 15th, 2023.
Well, we all have expectations now, don't we?
Anybody else from the public? Mr. Alexander. You're self-muted, Terry. Yeah, you're self-muted now, Terry. Anybody else online from the public? Let's see if Mr. Alexander can cure his problem. I don't see anyone. Terry, when you get squared away, I'll recognize you, and we're going to move on. So next I have NOAA GC, Mr. McDonald, Attorney McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A very brief update. There are no new court decisions from since the last council meeting in December. There's one procedural update of note, the Loper-Bright, in the Loper-Bright case that has been petitioned to the Supreme Court. The government had a due date of its response brief to that petition in January. The government sought to extend that date, and the court granted it, and so the government's brief is now due February 16th.
Okay, any questions for Mitch? Anybody in the audience? Anybody online? Seeing none. To the Science Center, Dr. Hare.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pentney mentioned the budget, FY23 budget has passed. We are still waiting to hear about what our allocation will be for the year. Mr. Pentney discussed how that then, once we get our allocation, we start the Amendment 23 spend plan process. So we could take some time on that. In terms of surveys, we did release an overview of our survey activities in 2022. I'm happy to share that with Mr. Neese so he can share with the council if there's interest. We were quite successful, but we did have some issues on the bottom trawl survey with COVID and some maintenance where we lost some stations in the Gulf of Maine and Georges Bank, which will be relevant to stock assessments going forward from the New England Council. And we do anticipate a HAB cam on an autonomous underwater vehicle, starting some trials with that this summer. We've been working with Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute to develop that vehicle and HAB cam on it. And we see that as part of one way to help us mitigate wind energy development in the region. Northeast Trawl Advisory Panel, I'll leave that to the report on the council has scheduled, and I'm happy to comment there if there's any questions. In terms of observer updates, NEFOP observers are working. They have 3,732 sea days planned for this year, and we've achieved about 2,790 of those up till January 17th. ASM coverage, which we've talked about here, set at 80%, and we're currently, the sectors are ranging between 36 and 88% across the 12 active sectors. We continue to have challenges with retention, and then we are working with Coonamessett Farm and Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission to train observers, to replace observers that are leaving. We also, as it came up earlier, vessels exiting the EM program during the fishing year also resulted in sort of increase in ASM coverage needs, which put a little more pressure on the system. And we continue to work very hard to have the observers in place to support the coverage rate that is needed under the Amendment 23 requirements. We are working with Office of Law Enforcement to conduct voluntary training to help us combat, harassment at sea. That next workshop is to be offered on January 26th from 1 to 2. They are virtual. In terms of the data backlog, which we've discussed here several times, our training and data quality branch continues to make progress on the backlog. We're currently about 1.5 months behind our normal schedule, and we expect to be fully caught up by March 31st, the end of the second quarter, end of our second quarter in the fiscal year, end of the first quarter calendar year. In terms of assessments, again, we're reporting on behalf of the Northeast Regional Coordinating Council. It's a joint process. We have the stock assessment schedule is on the NRCC webpage. We've done some updates to the stock assessment process document, which was posted on that webpage. The NRCC recently formed a research track steering committee to oversee the research track process. This was sort of the last piece that was envisioned when we revised the stock assessment process starting in 2019. That research track steering committee will be working to sort of look out, identify research questions, and identify stocks that would be suitable for a research track assessment, or identify questions that would be suitable for a research track assessment. Working groups, a number of research track working groups continue to meet regularly. Black sea bass, a topic-based applying state-based models in the Atlantic Cod working group, and we've had a number of working groups that have completed their work in 2022, butterfish, haddock, elex squid, American plaice, spiny dogfish, and bluefish, and then we have several research track working groups which have recently gotten started, golden tilefish, yellowtail flounder, and the sea scallop working group had their first meeting, I believe it was on Friday. In terms of the catch data, we've talked about the catch accounting and monitoring system, which was being developed jointly by the regional office and the Science Center. There was a peer review that was held last week, January 17th to 19th, and the peer review went well, and we are expecting the reports back, sort of give them about a month or so, and then we will look at those reports and address them as needed. But I think we are, getting to the place where we're going to have one integrated catch accounting and monitoring system in the region, which has been a sort of a task on the list to do for a while. Cooperative research, there's a number of activities underway. They have held their two Northeast Research Summits, one in January in Newport News, which has been happened, and then there's one in Providence in February. They have been very well attended and in essence full, and so that's excellent that we're getting a lot of feedback in terms of how to improve and how to work more cooperatively. And the Gulf of Maine Bottom Longline Survey is one of the activities that's conducted by that group, and 2023 will be their 10th year for the survey, and we're starting to see the value of that investment as those data are used, starting to be incorporated into our stock assessments. Study Fleet is looking to recruit 5 new vessels for 2023, and if captains are interested, I can provide the contact, or Katie Bouchard, who works at the Science Center, can help interested vessels join Study Fleet. Protected species, we're going to hear about some of the developments with regard to on-demand gear here today at this meeting. But of note, the decision support tool, which estimates entanglement risk for North Atlantic right whales across the region, there will be a peer review next week, and that review will be led by the Atlantic Scientific Review Group, which is a group set up under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And so then we will look at the recommendations from that review and make adjustments to that decision support tool. In terms of offshore wind, there's a lot going on. BOEM recently, put out sort of their slightly reduced areas in the Gulf of Maine. We are working to understand the overlap with those areas with our survey activities, and sort of understanding the impacts on the ecosystem and on the fisheries is also a priority for us. We are continuing to develop our ecosystem and socioeconomic profiles, and they are being done in the Atlantic Cod research track, and they were completed in the Bluefish research track as well. So trying to bring more socioeconomic information into the stock assessment process through the research track working groups. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will stop and happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Hare. Any questions from the council? Ms. Eitri.
Thanks. Couple questions / comments. Specific to the missing stations on Georges Bank because of either breakdown or COVID, has there been, and I'm sure that there is, but any initial discussions looking at that data and thinking through the track assessment process and what kind of implications that could have, if any?
We haven't really gotten into the implications of those missing data. All strata were sampled, but a reduced number of stations per strata. So there will be strata estimates, but likely the variance around those estimates will be greater because of fewer stations.
Yeah, go ahead.
Then I guess the next two are just, one's an observation and one is actually a thank you. So just an observation and taking full responsibility that for a good portion of December, I took some time off and I wasn't paying attention during the holidays. So if I missed it, I own it. But it seems like with a lot of the peer reviews you're conducting, that notification to the general public seems to be coming out really late. I didn't find out about the CAMS review until I was listening to a PDT call. So to the extent, and I saw yesterday the announcement about the take reduction decision tool peer review, but to the extent that maybe internally folks could look at a more earlier communication, I know someone had mentioned, well, it was in the FR notice, and I follow a lot of things, but even I miss FR notices. So just an observation about maybe some different communications to get the notice about peer reviews on people's schedules sooner than a couple days before. And then just this is actually a thank you to both you and the regional office. The transition to Amendment 23, I think we all expected to be relatively smooth because it was pretty much the same thing we've been doing. But I know, speaking for myself, both your staff and GARFO staff worked with me to help with some nuances with one of my vessels that uses max retention. And so I just want to thank you for that and for anybody else that you helped, because acknowledging the fishing needs of, you know, that business and everybody else that was transitioning and working with them to make sure that they could keep going fishing and understand what's happening is very much appreciative to the guys on the water. So I just want to say thank you to all of your staff for that. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And in terms of the peer review announcements, we recognize that particularly with the CAMS review that we were late in getting that information out there. I think we're pretty good on our stock assessment side. And now we're starting to do these peer reviews sort of outside of our normal stock assessment process, and it's getting staff involved in those reviews sort of up to speed to get the information out sooner. So we completely appreciate the point, and we are working on it.
Yep. Mr. Salerno.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the update, Dr. Hare. I had a quick question related to the at-sea monitoring coverage numbers that you had. You said you were roughly between... some sectors were low, some sectors were high. Do you know if these numbers include any of these new at-sea monitoring exempted trips or some of the older exempted trips? Just the reason why I ask is because one of my sectors I work with is at the lower end, and it is taking advantage of the new 7130, so I expect my coverage rate to even go lower. So I'm just curious if those numbers included or excluded those ASM exempted trips.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have the details with me right here, but I think, you know, for those sector specific questions, you know, there's a monthly sectors managers meeting. It'd be a good thing to raise there with staff so they can provide you the details.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Anyone else from the council? I have a question, Dr. Hare. Is there any more discussion about port sampling at all?
Yes. So again, the issue is our port sampling, the regional office's port sampling budget has been flat. Costs are going up. The number of port samples taken are going down. That's a, we're having that issue across our whole portfolio, and it's playing out in port sampling as well. We have a meeting set up with Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. I'm not quite sure, in the next couple of weeks, not next week and not next month, but somewhere in between, to talk with them about, is there a coordinated approach that we can do working with the states. And in the interim, Massachusetts Department of Marine Fisheries reached out with sort of some ideas about how they could help with the situation. And so we're planning to get a group together from the Science Center and from MassDMF to talk about port sampling. Thank you to MassDMF for being proactive and recognizing the problem and willing to, talk about how we can work on solving it. On the budget side, we haven't gotten, as I said, we haven't gotten our allocations yet. I didn't see any increases in those lines that could help the port sampling. So I think this kind of, mix and matching solutions is where we are right now.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Nice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got several questions. I guess I'll start with a number of questions the staff has related to the CAMS review. So to start with, what are the plans for including stocks in CAMS that are not currently in CAMS, in particular for stocks where assessments are coming up soon, blueback herring, the Atlantic Herring Research Track is supposed to start relatively quickly, and our understanding is herring is not included in CAMS yet. What is the timeline for getting those deficiencies corrected?
I will need to get back with you on that, Mr. Nice. Atlantic herring data, there's close collaboration with Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, so that is a different catch data stream than the commercial dealer stream, so I will get back to you on that.
Thanks. The other thing is our staff noted that in a lot of the working papers presented at the review, there were some pretty big discrepancies between, the two different data sources that were corrected when it comes to discard estimates, or some stocks anyway. I think, for example, one of the issues that I recall somebody mentioning was that there was a lot of deep sea red crab being discarded by state waters lobster fisheries, which obviously doesn't make a lot of sense. So, how are those, maybe that particular issue has been resolved, so I don't want to leave the impression that's still outstanding, because I'm not sure. But are all those discard issues being addressed? Do we have a path forward for fixing those yet?
Yeah, I mean, I think the path forward is, like all of our data, when somebody sees something that doesn't make sense, to raise it. Maybe we need to set up a more formal way for those types of discrepancies to be flagged for the regional office and for the Science Center to look at. But then we would look at the issue and make any necessary changes. And I don't think we see the CAM system as something that is now fixed in stone. I think we will continue to make improvements to the data and the processes of the system as we sort of see deficiencies, as you're pointing out.
So that's a perfect lead into my last question. Mid-Atlantic and New England Council staff for a long time have asked to be incorporated into the review of CAMS because we use the data in different ways than the stock assessment scientists do and that the regional office does. And so, you know, our feeling is that if we were allowed to look at the data, it's entirely possible that the council staffs and perhaps the commission staff may notice unusual things that are not being noticed at the by the NIMS staff. What are the plans, if any, for taking advantage of that expertise and having the staff of the these management bodies look at the data to see what discrepancies they can find, or if they find any?
So again, I'm not aware of any formal plans to have council staff or commission staff work through the CAMS data with agency staff. We did hold the couple of sort of briefings before the peer review with council and commission staff to get them familiar with the system. But if there is interest, we can sort of discuss how to set up sort of a formal arrangement whereby council and commission staff could provide comments on the workings of CAMS.
So what are the steps to reflect that interest, since this is something that I know I have brought up at the NRCC meeting repeatedly?
Well, we did have, again, we had this sort of we got staff together before the peer review. We've now had the peer review. So it sounds like, I don't know if it's a workshop or a working meeting to sort of walk, to go through things. But Mr. Pentney and I can discuss and get back to you formally or informally at your desire.
Thanks. If I could, Mr. Chair, I'd like to shift gears just for a second. I just wanted to call attention, because I'm not sure all the council members noticed it, that the Science Center sent us a letter, which is in the binder under the Science Center Reports section, which provided a number of answers to questions that were asked last fall regarding observer coverage, cooperative research, and some other things. I don't know, Dr. Hare, if you intended to introduce that letter later in the meeting, or if any council members had any questions on that letter. It addressed some of the issues I know that we're talking about at the Groundfish Committee meeting last week with respect to observers and, you know, number of, in broad terms anyway, number of trips that may have got a waiver and that are covered. So I don't know if you were planning to wait and bring that up during the groundfish discussion, or if council members wanted to talk about that letter now.
And I wasn't planning on bringing it up, but thank you for noting it. And again, we're happy to answer questions about the information provided in that letter now, during the groundfish discussion, or at any time anyone wants to raise a question with us.
So I'll kick it off.
Thank you.
I guess I've got two questions. There's one statement that I think is in the letter that talks about funds that may be left over from previous years. And I think one of the numbers is something like $3 or $3.4 million that can only be spent on electronic monitoring. I guess I have two questions. Was the amount that was set aside for purchase of EM equipment specified for Congress, or was that what the agency proposed in its spend plan? And if the latter, what is the agency's plan for spending that money before, if it does, expire or go away at some time?
So again, it wasn't specified in the language, but it was in our spend plan to Congress. If it appears that those funds are likely to not be spent, we could consider, you know, moving those funds to a different category, reimbursing sector administrative costs or reimbursing for ASM. There's a relatively small, from the federal government perspective, procedural step that we need to go through, but our intent is to not have any of the money expire.
Thanks. And then the next question I had is, there's two figures, well, one figure in the report that shows 2 years that describes how the industry costs were expended. in terms of percents what the money went to. But I'm curious what the total spent for industry cost was each of those 2 years, and how that compared to the other money that was spent, for example, on shoreside costs.
So, yeah, I mean, I do have this information, so thank you to KB McArdle and the Observer Program for putting this together in advance of this meeting. In fiscal year 2021, ASMFC reimbursed $2.4 million for industry costs, and a total of $3.4 million was allocated. Meanwhile, $6.1 million was allocated and spent on shoreside and other costs, including training and equipment. In fiscal year 2022, ASMFC reimbursed $3.9 million for industry costs. A total of $4.5 million was allocated to industry in that fiscal year, and $5.5 million was allocated and spent on shoreside and other costs. So we continue to work to bring the shoreside costs down, and we continue to have enough funding to support the industry costs. We are starting to work with the sectors to understand the language which approved the reimbursement of some sector administration costs, which would something we haven't started yet, but we'll be starting probably this fiscal year.
Thank you, Dr. Erd. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
August 1st, you said? Okay. Tom opened up Pandora's box. I don't know if anybody has any questions for Dr. Hare before I go to the public. If not, we can certainly talk about, again, underground fish. I don't see any other hands. So anybody from the audience? Anybody online? Seeing none, back to the council. Ms. Eitri.
It's not really a question as much as just restating something that I've stated before, and I think the letter highlights it. There is a huge impact of COVID when it related to having observers, and it was a monumental feat of the Observer Program to get the program where it is today with the coverage that we currently have. So as the response to it, it's a highly complicated process, and it doesn't even really capture the complexities of the at-sea monitoring, EM, NEPOP, everything. But I just want to, again, acknowledge that the NEPOP program has really, and it's not just NEPOP, I'm sure the regional office as well, have strived to get this fishery as many monitors trained and coverage as we can to get us to the coverage rate that we are. So I know myself, I view it as a Herculean effort, and thank you for that. And I think that we're just going on an upward trajectory, but I'd also highlight folks to be really mindful of the slide that talks about retention, because that's going to be a constant issue that everyone faces through no fault of their own, trying to get this program to a high level of coverage. We're going to fight that with retention issues. So just want to say thank you for the work that's been done. It's admirable to date.
Thank you very much. I do, you know, it raises an interesting issue. You know, the regional administrator, you had set the coverage rate at 99, and then we went back and reset it at 80. And that was purposeful because, you know, it became clear through the budget that we were not going to be able to achieve 99, and we didn't want the expectation to be out there that the industry was going to have to meet 99. We just need to continue that communication, understand what's a realistic observer rate to achieve, and set the observer rate close to that, and not have unrealistic expectations for industry or the observer program.
Okay, before I will move on to the next set of reports, Mr. Alexander, you got your mic fixed? Okay, sorry, Terry. Next up, we have Mid-Atlantic Liaison Report. The Mid-Atlantic Council met after our meeting in December. Some of the highlights are they're still working on their surf clam and ocean quahog species separation amendment. That's a continuing action. As Mr. Pentney said, they set 2023 recreational management specs for fluke, scup, and sea bass.
They also had a discussion about priorities and next steps for several of the recreational reform initiative topics, and that was joined with the ASMFC. They agreed with our decision to delay findings on Monkfish, and they meet in 2 weeks to see if we can end Monkfish for this year. They approved their implementation plan, their priorities for 2023, and they also discussed the Hudson Canyon National Marine Sanctuary. They did send a letter recommending no further action is needed, which we'll talk about under our agenda. They meet in 2 weeks, and if you look under tab 9, you can see the meeting summary, the motions, and the agenda for the February meeting. Most of their February meeting is going to mirror what we're going to talk about here today. So if there's any questions on the Mid-Atlantic, I'm happy to take them. Anybody in the audience? Anybody online? Okay, very good. So I'm going to give the ASMFC report. Ms. Kearns asked me to give the report, and the report is they don't have anything to report on because they haven't had a meeting since their last meeting. Just so you know, they have a couple of topics they're going to be talking about next week. One is a progress report on lobster tracking devices. They've got 4 approved devices, and we're going to get a progress report on that. And they're also going to have a refresher on Robert's Rules of Order. It's you're all welcome to become experts in Robert's Rules of Order. And if you didn't take that, that would be fine with me because I'm not an expert either. So, and I'm not going to take questions because I probably don't have any answers. So with that, we're going to move on to our next report, which will be Captain Frederick from the Coast Guard.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, council members, members of public. I'll be reporting our enforcement and safety numbers for the past 50 days or so. It's a little bit of an abbreviated report since our last meeting in December. Just a note as we start, I reported, I think maybe last or the meeting previous to that, that we are getting 6 new ships here in New England. The picture is of the first fast response cutter. That's the William Chadwick. We commissioned her in November, and she's completed, I think, about 3 operational periods since then. So I think about 16 of the boardings that we report today were from Chadwick, and just incredible ships. They bring a lot of capability, and we'll be commissioning the 2nd of 6 in March. And I don't remember the exact number. We will commission one in Portsmouth for members of the public that are here, and I think that one is maybe October. So we're spreading the commissionings around New England. A little bit of a different model for the Coast Guard. As many of you may be aware, we've had patrol boats that have been stationed in places like Gloucester probably since the Rum Runner days. The new model for our patrol boats are the 6 ships are all going to be home ported in Boston, and that really comes down to maintenance and logistics and clustering those for better cost effectiveness of your tax dollars. So we'll go ahead and push ahead here. So for the past 50 days or so, we've conducted 194 boardings, 8 violations for a 96% compliance rate. 7 of those were fishing permit violations. Then we had 1 fishing in a restricted area. That was actually a joint boarding we did with Maine Marine Patrol up off of Eastport, and it was a incursion inside of a salmon pen boundary that Maine Marine Patrol issued a violation for. Safety numbers. We conducted 58 dockside boardings, issued 42 decals, 195 at-sea boardings, 95 violations issued aboard 53 vessels, and 3 terminations this period for a 73% compliance rate. And you can see those violations there from EPIRB to documentation flares, and then a handful for survival craft and PFDs. Search and rescue cases, we responded to 13 commercial fishing vessel incidents. 8 of those were equipment casualties, 3 groundings, 2 sinkings. I think actually those numbers, if we go to present, we had a few over the weekend too, so they're probably a little bit higher. But 22 fishermen assisted and 1 non-fishing related death, which was a medical emergency. And pending any questions, Mr. Chairman, that's all I have to report.
Okay, thank you, Captain. Any questions? Anybody from the public? Anybody online? Seeing none, thank you very much. Next up, Mr. Gilbert for NOAA enforcement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Morning, council members. Related to our continued